right now to buy my home, I need to go to a bank, have them approve me. I need to get money from someone in order to pay somebody else for this house. And that money comes from one bank. With DeFi, that money can come from many, many people. There might be one service, but there could be 100, 1,000 people that are saying, I'm willing to loan money to somebody with this that meets this kind of criteria. And then they get the interest.
All right, welcome back to another episode of People of Product. My name is George Brooks, and today I'm joined by the very infamous, the very famous, I don't know, the pretty normal co-host of this thing we do called Daniel.
Ordinary. ordinary man for extraordinary times. There you go.
And if you were on our last episode, if you heard our last episode, we had a special guest as well, and that's Mr. Tyler Hilker. It's good to have you with us.
You know, it's always good to be here. Hello, special Tyler. Or not, I'm happy to be here.
I think we're all ordinary in our own way, and we're all special in our own way, and I like it that way.
That was nice.
Yeah.
Appreciate that.
Hey. We're trying a new podcasting system, so would love the feedback. If this sounds better, if it sounds worse, just let us know. We're going to straight into the new year with some new tools and trying out some new things. Tyler, you sound delicious. You sound great with the new
Thank
mic.
You. Delicious.
New year, new mic.
Nice. You're fabulous, Tyler.
New beard.
If you listened to last episode, you knew that we're jumping into this very popular, very exciting, very new to most people space, but not actually new to the world, technically speaking.
Called
Web3. In the first episode and that last episode, we talked through this idea of what was Web1, which is really kind of the dawn of publishing pages, mostly hosted on computers that were underneath your desk or something that was in your house or your office. Then Web 2.0 is the dawn of web applications, mobile apps, and cloud-based computing. And we've kind of seen these different ways of thinking about computing. And now Web3 is a new type of computing. It's a new way of thinking about where our data is, how it's stored, how it's decentralized now through blockchain and through a decentralized server model. And there's a lot of opportunities for that. We're seeing, obviously, a huge uptick in Twitter chatter and social media chatter around NFTs and crypto and DeFi and dApps and all these words, right?
There's a little bit of jargon.
There's some jargon.
So many words.
There's just so many words. So this episode today is really not necessary for you if you're someone who is already very familiar with the Web3 universe. This is really, honestly, it's a bit of learning for us to force us to go do a little research, to wrap our heads around some words, some jargon, some vocabulary. And we're going to kind of rapid hit some of the top jargon terms, the top vocabulary of the Web3 movement, the Web3 universe, kind of building from the ground up. Kind of what is the infrastructure vocabulary, and then all the way up to some more things that you've probably seen if you've been paying attention to the internet, or even, guys, I told Tyler this, I was watching a clip from, I don't know, it was like MSNBC or something like that, and one of the investment shows, and they were talking about like whether or not each of them was going to buy a Bored Ape or a CryptoPunk, and the valuations of that over stock prices, right? Mm. So what a weird time to be alive when it's like, do I invest into this this fund or into bonds, or do I buy a Bored Ape?
Well, it's interesting too, because this kind of news is the speed at which news moves, it outpaces so many other conversations. Yeah. And so it's really easy to have no idea what any of this is talking about, because it's easy to be in a certain bubble, for better or worse.
That is exciting, though.
Yeah.
It got to the headlines, you know, and then it's, to me, I mean, I'm known about it for, you know, maybe a year and a half or 2 years or whatever, but I would say from the beginning of 2021 throughout it, the escalation of all the news coverage that it was getting, particularly, you know, Bitcoin, Ethereum, you know, blockchain itself, cryptocurrency, all of that. Just, I did a hockey stick from a news coverage, you know, and I'm sure you could, there's got to be a chart out there somewhere as far as the amount of news coverage it got. And then when that happens, obviously it just becomes more and more, even though it's not ubiquitous because it's so confusing, which is why we're having these episodes to unpack this, but it just seems ubiquitous from a, you know, you're at a party. It's like, hey, do you hear about this whole blockchain thing? I mean, everyone, seriously. And they're like, what is it?
Christmas,
and most people
are
like, I don't know.
NFTs to my aunt, you know, my, it's
for sure.
To go back.
Out of curiosity, can anybody pinpoint what was, and Tyler, you've been probably paying attention to this more than most. What was the event? What was the, all I can think about is like when Gary Vaynerchuk did V Friends or when CryptoPunks hit at this next level, when Bored Apes started to have this valuation, then everybody went like, what? But blockchain's been around for a while. Ethereum's been around for a while. I mean,
think it was Dogecoin.
I just
felt like that spiked.
So
that's a good point.
CryptoPunks, I mean, Bitcoin's been around for over a decade now, and blockchains have been slowly building. Ethereum's several years old, and other what we call layer one, other basic systems are a few years old. But what happened earlier this year outside of that particular ecosystem, we had people not going to work, spending a lot of time at home, whether voluntarily or lost their jobs. They were quarantined. And they were in a way bored, and they were tied to their computers or their phones. And the government started handing out checks because they needed to compensate people for lost wages or whatever it was. And so people had disposable time and disposable income. And that is pretty closely tied to this rise in activity, specifically in crypto and NFTs, because Bored Apes came out early last year, because it's now 2022. But
yeah,
Bored Apes haven't been around that long. CryptoPunks, I think, were started in 2017. So that's been around for a while. But it was this confluence of technology, people being bored, a certain groundswell around this kind of activity, and the discussion around the Bitcoin halving and how certain events and changes in price coincide with that particular thing. And so you get people talking about doubling or quadrupling or whatever, 5x on their money. That's going to get people really interested. And so that kind of sucked a lot of people into this whole ecosystem.
That's really interesting you say that, Tyler, because that connects. And again, I don't know, you know, I don't think there's causation and there may not be correlation, but there's something there around the concept of yield farming. And you mentioned that a lot of individuals, you know, they were getting checks over and over again. On a lot of the research I was doing came up of individuals that have made a ton, you know, however many X by yield farming, which is essentially day trading. But through different strategies and protocols of, you know, what they call liquidity pools and lending and borrowing, but you have to do it almost on a daily basis, if not even faster than that. And so a lot of them have been, like you said, work from home, they have disposable income, and that could be anybody. But if you get, if you latch on and understand that concept quickly, there was a lot of people and still are. Making a lot of money from, you know, yield farming, which we might get into later. But I'm just saying that's interesting that you make that point. People at home day trading, essentially.
And you mentioned, I want to touch on that as well. So yield farming and staking. Staking is basically putting your money, instead of in a bank, you put it with a stake pool or some sort of provider, and then you get staking rewards, which are kind of like interest from your bank. And those are pretty easily 5% and up, whereas people in a savings account in their bank are
less
getting
than
0.5% maybe.
So
the appeal there to say, hey, I'll put some, I'll put a little bit of money here just to see what it does, because the reward is worth that particular risk. And given the other broader macroeconomic factors of inflation and whatnot, it was just pretty appealing to a lot of people.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think we need to take a step back. We went kind of the, okay, that's the end goal. what we just talked about there, that the is vortex. The end of this.
It sucks you
yeah,
in.
This is the vortex. And, yeah, and what you'll find
make your
is
your head
that,
spin.
Well, what's interesting for me, and Tyler, you tried to explain this whole space to me, at least. I know probably to Dan as well. Mm-hmm. And at first pass, I was like, all right, yeah, cool. I'm kind of familiar, but I don't really care. And then it was like, of course, then all this press and stuff started to happen. And then you were like, no, really, it's like this, 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 and this. And there was so much jargon. There was so much barrier to entry. It wasn't easy to understand because the bridges weren't built in my brain, nor were the analogies quite apples to apples, right? Mm-hmm. And so what we want to do is just kind of as easily as we can, I want to march through some terms, some basic terms. So again, this is not going to be a like expert course. There is a ton of resources by the way online for all this. You could just Google like what is Web3, or that's basically what we just did. But I want to bring us back, because the purpose of this podcast is not necessarily to talk about the cutting edge tech. And so some people that have been listening to this podcast for a long time are like, weren't you guys working on a framework last year? Isn't this all about like product culture? And I think what I want to remind us as we jump into this like period of learning is, as a team, as Crema, we're learning right now. We're playing, we're exploring. And if you remember back to the framework, one of the key disciplines was exploration. And so as we think about how we may one day be able to contribute for our clients, that we might be able to bring our teams in and start using some of this technology or leveraging it or thinking about the possibilities, we don't even know what we can and can't do if we don't play a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to bring it back just a little bit about why is the People of Product podcast talking about Web3 when that's more of like a technology breakdown. We want to kind of show you a little bit behind the scenes of how we play. How we explore, how we research, how we learn. So,
and cultures exist in context too. And so our product culture exists. This is part of the greater context in which we exist. And so as we explore, we're exploring that context. And so it makes sense to not only look at our product culture, but what's the field? What's the field of vision and the field of play that we play within?
Yeah, perfect. Okay, so let's start. It's not actually the beginning, but let's start at the base. And I'm gonna look at my notes here to make sure that I'm in line, because we've been kind of thinking about, there's a couple different ways we could splice this, but I think that if we go back to the base, we have to start with blockchain, right?
Agreed.
So let's start there. We mentioned in the first episode, but let's go back. What do we mean when we say all of this technology, all of these different, you know, whether it's how you think about accessing through a wallet or games or DeFi or whatever, they're all existing on this thing called blockchain. What is the blockchain, or what is a blockchain?
A blockchain is a sort of database that can only be read and written to. It cannot be modified, and it lives usually on a bunch of different computers. How many is dependent on the protocol itself, but you'll hear these words in the blockchain parlance, in the blockchain community, things like immutable. That means it can't be changed. You'll hear,
which is weird. Just as a side note, I got to pause you right there. That to me already is like, you mean I can't edit the data in the database? That sounds crazy to me.
And I think what you just said, George, real quick, is key, that for anyone listening, knowing, because this is what I experienced, that every single aspect of what we're going to talk about, for me, it was layers upon layers of understanding. Yeah. Yeah. So even Tyler said a database that's immutable, depending on the protocol. Pause. For me, it's like, okay, protocol, depending on the protocol. Rules. Okay. Someone defined, okay, rules. There we, yeah. So anyways, keep going.
Bitcoin is a protocol. Ethereum is a protocol.
Right.
A lot of the big names that you'll hear are protocols, and that's simply a way of building blockchains. It's a set of code. And to the bigger point, the struggle that I've had in learning all this is trying to keep the analogies where I say a blockchain is like a database. Well, it is, but it it's not like a database in the way that we understand databases.
It's not exactly.
Like,
yeah, right.
Like Chris Dixon would say, it's a blockchain is a computer. And he gets a lot of flack for that, but he's not wrong, but it's just not a computer in the way that we're used to thinking. And so we've got to hold these definitions in a way loosely, at least as they relate to the things we already understand, because we can misunderstand pretty easily or misinterpret what these things are. And so it's all of this is an exercise of remapping the way that I think about technology and the way it has to happen onto new concepts.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Tyler, but when we think about a blockchain, traditionally speaking, it's not storing large sets of data in the same way that like an Amazon S3 server would be storing images or video files or, you know, even applications themselves. The blockchain primarily is storing a ledger or a, am I correct in saying that, or is that only true for certain protocols?
The latter. It's a blockchain is a series of blocks that are chained together in series, building on one another. And each block contains data. Blockchain specific. Okay. So Bitcoin is a ledger, strictly. This account.
I see.
This much to this particular account. But there are projects out there that store files. There are projects that store other kinds of data. The problems that they're solving are just different. But if you think, like, for an analogy, and this is not, again, this is a loosely held analogy, but if you think back to the Napster or the Tor or the Pirate Bay days, those were files stored.
Those were the days. Just as a side note,
no comment. But those applications worked. They were peer-to-peer in that I had an application on my computer that I could access files that were stored on other people's computers around the world. And then if I said, download this file, it would pull from those files around the world. And so it's not the exact same thing, but again, I'm going for loosely held metaphors here.
Yeah. And we can't get too deep because this needs to stay as high level as possible.
One analogy that helped me, when I was first researching this a couple months ago was around think of a box of receipts. So think of in your storage room or whatnot, a block is a box of receipts or transactions or events that's stored in the block. And then when that box gets too full from January 2020 and you go into February 2020, it's another box of receipts and it's in chronological order and each one points to the one before it or prior to it. And so each block it's a chain of events or transactions, or in this analogy, it's a box of receipts. Oh, the box is too full. You move on to the next one and then you move on to the next one.
Yeah. And to that point, there's not yet a great case for blockchains to be used in every situation. So we're not quite there. And so before people go out thinking, oh, Chrome is building everything on Web3 and blockchains, we're not even close to that at this point. It's good for very specific kinds of ledgers, information, that kind of thing. There are projects out there that are exploring all kinds of cool different ways to use blockchains, but we're not about to replace Django or anything like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So let's move forward a little bit. So I think that kind of sets at least the foundations for just a blockchain. Simply put, it is a new type of database. It's usually spread across multiple computers. The volume we don't know for sure. It has different protocols, different purposes. It can be deployed in different ways, accessed in different ways. So let's take it down to the.
I want to interject on an important point that. Nobody owns the blockchains, at least in their idealized state. Nobody owns Bitcoin.
Yeah.
There's a group of people that get together to decide what happens with Bitcoin, and same thing with Ethereum and these other chains. And so they usually start out what we call centralized. So that means there's an organization who's investing in building this thing out, and then they build a community, which then takes on the ownership of what we call nodes or computers that are running this particular blockchain program, and eventually it is owned by the community, and the community will decide what changes need to be made in order to help this thing thrive and get more people to use it and just make it good all around. So the ownership is a key component of blockchains.
Yeah, which is a paradigm shift, really, because you were so used to either, again, Web 1, I was owning my server because it was sitting next to me and I controlled what was on it and who saw it and everything else. Web 2 was cloud-based, so I was renting storage from a conglomerate, usually in a server farm someplace, either distributed or in one place. But it was owned by Google, Amazon, Microsoft, et cetera. And this is now saying, while I may own a miner, I may own a server, I may own a node, I don't actually own what it's representing, mm-hmm. Which is the entire blockchain, mm-hmm. that the protocol it's on.
Right.
Yep. That's okay. Right.
Okay. Good. So let's move forward. So there are lots of things to unpack even in blockchain. So we did not even scratch the surface of all the technical aspects of how that technology works or the pros and cons of it. So that's not what we're trying to do here. We just want to give some basic definition here. So let's move forward into smart contracts. So on the blockchain, you have smart contracts. So what is a smart contract? I know what a contract is. I'm not very good at reading them or writing them, but I know what one is. What is a smart contract?
Yeah. So, yeah. And Tyler, as our expert, correct me, but smart contracts came along on Ethereum. They're primarily on Ethereum, and they can be defined. So when you're making a contract let's call it a commitment between two parties, typically you might have an intermediary that's verifying that an event took place. So if you have a claim, an insurance claim, they have to verify some level of a third party has to verify that this happened, so that then at some point compensation can be released or certain factors can be released. Where the smart contract operates pretty much the exact same way, except the contract is digital, it's code-based, and it will deliver on the promises as long as certain criteria are met that has been coded into the contract. So for example, let's go back to like a real estate deal. So, and then again, this is, I think this is coming. I don't know if there's anything like this yet, but I would say this is coming.
Who's going to make their house an NFT? Come on now.
Right. So right now we'll just say this is more of an analogy, but it fits really well. There you go. Say title companies. So if I'm making, so George wants to buy a piece of property that I own. So there's a selling price and he's the buyer. And then there has to be some level of a verification of that. So a title company or some other type of company that's verifying that, yes, I own it, I can sell it, and George is buying it. And then once the transaction happens, funds are released. So funds will go from his bank to mine because he's purchasing my property. What a smart contract will do is all of that, those stipulations are coded into the code on top of blockchain. And once those stipulations happen, there's no intermediary. It's a trustless system, meaning that we don't have to bank on the trustworthiness of the intermediary, the third party. We bank on the trustworthiness of the code. And so when that happens, then funds, even if it's on a Sunday, again, isn't it bound by time when the third party is working or happens to have office hours or the market's open or whatever that is, funds will immediately go from my account or from George's account to my account. And it can happen within a matter of hours or even a day versus having to be held up in escrow or whatnot.
Minutes for that matter. Yeah,
exactly. And so again, there's the third party is there rendered. It's not necessary anymore. And again, there's so many different uses of smart contracts, but that is a little bit of an analogy of how those work.
Yeah. You mentioned at the end, but the escrow piece is in that scenario, it's the key piece because we use escrow because we don't trust the third party. And I've had business deals that I've tried to, we couldn't agree on an escrow partner because this guy wanted one and I wanted another and we kept going back and forth. And had we been able to, decade ago, but had we been able to use smart contracts in this way, we could have said, all right, let's write up contract. We can both validate it because these contracts are simply data sitting on a blockchain. And so they're open source. Anybody can look into them and see, given the rules within this contract, this is what will happen. Mm-hmm. And so anybody can validate whether or not it has bugs in it, or if it will actually do what it say it's going to do. If I add this money to this contract, will it actually give me this particular record, or will it not? It can be validated by anybody.
Right. Right.
We'll come back to this later, but this is probably the area that I'm most curious about for Crema, because as we start thinking about our clients, both whether they're enterprises or small businesses or even individuals, startups that are thinking about building value in different areas, mm-hmm. or exchanging value for something else. This is where we can get into NFTs or into, yep. Even services could be exchanged over a smart contract, right? Then it becomes really interesting, because again, we're getting rid of, in theory, you're kind of getting rid of a middleman, but that is software now that has to be built. Because as mm-hmm. I understand it, basically a smart contract is more like a piece of software, an application that's running on the blockchain,
right?
That is making a certain set of claims that the group agrees to. And then you get really interesting with it, and we'll get into this in a second, but then you get into the point where those contracts can be nuanced to say, for example, I sell a piece of art as an NFT. We'll get to what NFTs are here in a second. But I can write into the smart contract that there are royalties that I'll get for every subsequent transaction, which has never really been done with art before. So then you start unlocking all these opportunities, because it's a piece of software that it's no longer held in like, well, you know, I stole the painting, so, you know, whatever. You can see it happen throughout its life cycle, because again, you can't delete that information. That data always will exist on the block. So, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What else to add to smart contracts? I think that was a really great overview, Dan.
I think it's fascinating, to be quite honest.
It's huge. The potential
idea.
It's going to take over everything.
And the fact that the blockchain and the community can verify the contract that it happened. And so that's why it just seems. Now, again, there are risks, you know, whether it's, you know, bugs in the system, as bugs can happen in smart contracts, or the other thing that was fascinating to me is that depending on how robust the smart contract can be, it can bog down. Well, that's my version mm-hmm. of bog down the system. And so obviously there's still a lot of things to work out, because the more these become normal, the system's going to have to be able to handle it. And as we all know, a paper contract, man, it can be very in depth and very, you know, this will only happen if like 17 different things happen. Or if you think of like, I mean, trusts or states, I mean, all of these different stipulations, the fact that they can be a smart contract is fascinating, but it's going to require just a lot more, the blockchain to be able to handle that robust of a contract. Right now, I think, you know, you can have a few stipulations, but because there's so many of them, it can't handle as much as, you know, right now, a paper contract can.
You touch on a really important lesson that we learned this year, where we spent some time going really hard trying to get what I've been calling getting a feel for the material of the blockchain. What is it like to not just learn about it and read about it, watch videos and buy crypto and NFTs and all this, but what does it look like to actually build with it? And
right.
There are lots of poorly written contracts, and not in the mm-hmm. sense of there's a lot of contracts that don't do what they say they're going to do. There's a lot of that. But there's a lot of, we're heading into territory where there are no paved roads. It is mm-hmm. not like building a React app and using Node for your backend and all this. There's so much that is unwritten, and people are kind of, figuring out as they go, because the resources just aren't there for here's how to do all this kind of thing. And so, and actually I say that. And that was true, especially true in April, May, and June. Now, even in the last couple of months, there have been a tremendous amount of resources that have been put out that help with that. But the strength and the elegance, I'll say, of a contract greatly impacts how much it will cost for you to execute that, especially on Ethereum. Mm-hmm. If it's a poorly written contract, it can cost significantly more, whether it's more data or just more transactions and whatnot. It gets complicated pretty quickly for folks.
I'm looking ahead. I don't know that we addressed the word, but I think it's a word that probably people are hearing that maybe they don't know. And correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe this applies to something we'll talk about here in a little bit. But that kind of plays into when we're talking about transaction, where we're talking about asking the blockchain to do some work. It's where specifically with Ethereum and a few other protocols, that's where you start getting into this term gas fees. Mm. And I want to kind of just call that out because I think a lot of people are confused as to what a gas fee is and is it who yep. gets that money and where is it, what's it for? Tyler, I want to throw that to you. Give us the short definition of like what is a gas fee? Because I think that's probably an area that people get caught up on.
Yeah. Gas fee is on the mostly on the Ethereum network. Other protocols might call it something else. But everybody has a fee to run to use the network. And so on Ethereum, mm-hmm. that's called gas. It's measured in a couple different units that fluctuate with how busy the network is. And those fees go to the people running Ethereum nodes. And it's a pretty complicated system, but in a way it's like an auction system where you say, I want the network to run this transaction. And then nodes will pick it up based on how much gas they get out of that. And so it's right. an incentive for people to run the network. And so you can think about it like it's the fee you pay your lawyer to write up this contract, much, much lower fee to write that contract, to run that contract. Right.
Because Tyler, correct me if I'm wrong, but because every transaction has to go through every single node on the blockchain, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
just,
correct.
It's just highly inefficient. And so, like you said, it's, you pay the network a fee.
Yeah. And I don't know that it goes through every single node. It usually goes through a certain number of confirmations.
Has to hit a certain percentage.
It goes through a threshold. So not, not every single one has to confirm.
Because you do run there is the theory that if you have a block that's apart from the network, that it couldn't be updated or offline or whatever. But once it's reconciled, there's.
Yeah. And just real quick, it goes for those confirmations because it needs to reach a certain consensus that says this wallet wants to send this money from this one to this one. The wallet sent, the sending wallet actually has that money and they need confirmation from these other nodes to say, yes, that's true. And then they need to confirm with the other wallet to say, yes, this has arrived in that other wallet. And there needs to be a certain level of consensus. And again, different protocols, different blockchains will have different methods of arriving at that. And that's part of why they cost different to run. That's part of why some are faster, some are slower. It's also part of why, and I'm not going to get into this, but just to say, it's also why more and more we're hearing about what are called roll-ups. So roll-ups will execute some of these or manage some of these transactions so that they can compensate for weaknesses of the actual blockchain.
Okay, I want to be mindful of time. Yeah, this is really good. So let's move forward. Let's jump over to DeFi. So again, if you've seen this term, it's the big D, little E, big F, little I that some people might have seen. Again, it's a Web3 term. It stands for decentralized finance. It's probably what people are most familiar with because of things like Coinbase. Do you think?
I think NFTs are more popular.
Well, maybe now. But I think that it started with, I think we saw more people interested in getting into this idea of decentralized finance, right? Whether it was like, I like Bitcoin. I like that it's basically free transactions for unlimited amounts of money. I think that it's faster. I think that there's all these derivatives and ways that we could think about it. Now, of course, NFTs have become more popular culture, but they're still on the backbone of paying for it with decentralized finance models, at least. But then there's DeFi in general, where there's actual applications or protocols or solutions that are all just about DeFi. So maybe just touch on that real quick. I don't want to spend too much time on this one because it touches on a bunch of the other ones. But what do we mean when we say DeFi?
Yeah. So as a quick analogy or an example, right now to buy my home, I need to go to a bank, have them approve me for that. And this is vast oversimplified. There's so many people intermediaries in here, but I need to get money from someone in order to pay somebody else for this house. And that money comes from one bank. And with DeFi, that money can come from many, many people. There might be one service, but there could be 100,000 people that are saying, I'm willing to loan money to somebody with this that meets this kind of criteria, and then they get they get the interest on whatever interest or whatever we call it, on whatever I pay to the service to use that. And so it's decentralized in that, the provider, the supplier of funds is decentralized as opposed to centralized, like a single bank might be now.
And yeah, again, it like takes out that middleman. So you could, I mean, you can really do peer-to-peer transaction models.
Yeah. If you were to ask someone, okay, describe the finance system, they'd probably say something, well, it includes insurance where I can get things, all different sorts of things insured. There's the stock exchange where I can put money in and earn, on my money through investment. I can make deposits in a bank so they can lend and borrow. And there's, you know, derivative trading as well. It's the same thing with DeFi, except it's digital. It's faster. And for example, I don't have to open up an account using my social security number. And do I don't have to have a third party facilitating the trade. So DeFi, again, works in that same way, except it's not centralized. It's decentralized, like we've been talking about. Wait,
you touched on something else that we kind of glossed over early on with blockchains, and specifically in DeFi. And this might be a segue into tokens, but
go ahead and take it there. Tokens is our next term. Yep.
I have an address, and a smart contract lives at an address. And I have an address as a user of the system. I have an address, and that's where the data lives. The data lives at a particular address. And so when I create that address, it's public. So how much money I have in any given address is public to everybody in the system. You can go right now and look up on etherscan.io how much money and the NFTs that are owned by a particular address. And so it comes back to this trustless system where if I apply for a loan through a particular DeFi service, they can look at the assets that I have in that address and know exactly how much money I have and whether or not I'm a risk in certain regards.
Yep. That's
and so
point to call out.
And that's, again, that's part of how the consensus thing works because every node has access to this public address.
Yep.
And then going into tokens, there are, two main kinds of tokens. There are like four or five, but, we have, a NFT, which is the more common kind of token that is a token that says you own something, and I'll come back to that. And then there are, an NFT stands for non-fungible token, fungible meaning readily exchanged with one another. So our dollar bills are fungible because $1 is the exact same value and representation as another. It doesn't matter which one I have. But an NFT is non-fungible in that it represents ownership of one unique item, like a baseball card or something like that, or my house for that matter, one unique item that I alone can own. And then there are tokens like governance tokens, which say, because I own this particular token, I get a certain level of voting privileges or responsibility as a part of whatever program or whatever protocol.
Is these token permissions, what it's for, what its purpose is, are they all written into the smart contracts?
Correct. So they're a part of that. So it's a separate smart contract. So, and they're separate tokens. So right now, I'm struggling to think of an example right now, but on the same protocol, I can have, I'll pick on Cardano. So Cardano, I can have ADA, which is their fungible currency.
I'm going to pause you for just 1 second. So there's Bitcoin, there's Ethereum there. And then you switched over to Cardano, which is another protocol network. Yep. So just so if you're not familiar with Cardano or haven't heard of it before, it'd be another place, another thing, if you want to put it in a category for your head, like Ethereum, like Bitcoin, but different. So keep going. Yep. I just wanted to make sure that's good.
And that's what we call a layer one. It's like a foundational piece of technology, like Bitcoin, Ethereum, that kind of thing. And I can have the fungible coin token, which is, it has its own ticker, it's ADA, and that has its own economic situation. And then there are governance tokens that I can use, and depending on how many governance tokens I have, I get a certain level of influence or say in terms of voting what happens with the protocol. And that's, again, I'm skipping ahead, but when we get to DAOs, decentralized autonomous organizations. Those are often governed by governance type tokens. You can't exchange them for money kind of
like,
in the same
like
way.
Voting rights. If you own a share, you have okay. Gotcha.
All right. And I want to, because I was just talking about NFTs, it's very important for us to remember that blockchain and crypto and NFTs and DeFi are not the same thing. They're mm-hmm. all very tightly interrelated, but mm-hmm. crypto is not NFTs, is not blockchains. They're built on blockchains, yes, but crypto and NFTs are different. And most of the critiques I hear of NFTs are that, oh, they're just JPEGs. I'll come back to that. And it's not just images, because an NFT represents ownership of the JPEG or of mm-hmm. the house or of whatever it is. It's like the deed to your house or the title to your car. The mm-hmm. NFT is a token that represents ownership of a different thing. And sometimes that thing is on a decentralized network. Sometimes it's on Amazon. Sometimes the image is just stored on AWS, for that matter, because where the thing itself lives is not as important as the security and knowledge of who owns it.
It's similar to, for example, we're in Kansas City and the what's the art museum? Oh my gosh.
Nelson Atkins,
right. They have a whole wing that's the Henry Block wing, right? And it's all of his collection of art. He's passed away now, but H&R Block, Henry Block. He donated all of his original art to be shown at the museum. But from what I've heard, I don't know if this is true, but what I understand is that he had replications made of all of that art to be put back in his house. And so now is the art in his house any different than the art that's in the museum? It's a copy of it, but the true valuable art is the thing that's in the museum, because it is owned. The original ownership is known of that original piece. So it doesn't matter if you copy it 1,000 times, the original is worth more, right?
Mm-hmm. And somewhere there's some certificate of ownership that says yes. These people own that and these people are in charge of it. Right. And again, I want to stress this, because I see this confusion everywhere, that the certificate of ownership is the NFT. It's yes. not the JPEG yes. or the object itself. And right. so when we get into, when going back to DeFi, that my house is not the NFT. But there could be NFTs representing ownership of my house mm-hmm. so that if I live in an up and coming neighborhood, I could put my house into the value of my house into NFTs. Other people buy that. I get that kind of liquidity, and then mm-hmm. I'm making money. They're making money when I sell the house or buy back the NFTs from them.
Which then gets into the whole crazy space of like taking out loans on the value of these tokens. And yeah, I mean, that's a whole nother level.
So many questions.
and like you said, it's unpaved territory. We don't know yet. There's some of that's already happening, but I think we're going to see even more of that coming. Okay. So we touched a little bit on from tokens. We touched on NFTs, non-fungible tokens. You touched on crypto, which is, it tends to be coins or a currency. And so mm-hmm. if anybody uses, Robinhood or, Coinbase or KuCoin or all these different exchanges where you can buy and sell coins, quote unquote, those are all different types of tokens that usually are tied back to a project or a protocol or something very specific that has a purpose, even if you don't know that when you're just buying and selling a certain number of them or a certain percentage of them in an exchange. Yeah, I think people might be familiar with buying and selling on Coinbase more than they are that ADA is tied to Cardano or that, Bitcoin was built for a particular purpose.
Yeah. And crypto right now is super interesting from a bird's eye perspective, but it's super risky financially. So
nothing here is financial advice. Let's remind people.
Very high risk, high reward.
And part of that is because it's unpaved territory. These organizations that are putting tokens out, some of them know what they're doing, some of them don't, some of them what you think they are. There's a lot of opportunity for what we call rugs, where you get somebody to invest in this thing and then you take all the money out and then you leave people hanging. And so it's hard because crypto gives people a new responsibility for their finances. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people aren't prepared for that. A lot of people just get into crypto and, where can I put $1,000 and get $100,000 in 5 years. It's like, well, it doesn't really work like that. And you need to pay more attention and be more responsible with it.
What a weird time to be alive too, because I think about maybe my parents' generation, the generation before, there were very savvy financial folks that were like their degrees were in that. Their education was based off of that because, mm-hmm. you know, they were going into something that would have to do with banking or finance. Now you're finding, and so everyone else got a job, got a paycheck, maybe earned a pension or an investment or a 401k that was managed by somebody else. They didn't look at it very often until they got to a retirement age, hoped they had money, and then they cash it out. They paid taxes at certain points along the line, et cetera. Now you're moving into a space where, one, there's very little regulation on any of this. And so people are creating value centers off of almost anything. They're just trying to find any way to create value centers off of anything. And now we have the technology to do it. So there's no constraint that's it's holding us back from what it could be used for yet until.
And that's part of what's exciting about it in that, it's exciting, but there's also a lot of risk because, it allows so many new entry opportunities for not just companies to do different things with crypto, but for new economic participation. Because again, in the world of DeFi, if I have a very low income, but I just got a new job, or if I just moved to the US, or there are situations where it's really, really hard for somebody to participate economically. And I'm not even like the US is pretty well grounded, but thinking in terms of South America or Africa or underdeveloped, less developed countries and
or underbanked population groups that just don't have access to the cost that it takes to have an entity known as a bank,
and being able to bank safely
without being taken advantage of, and I've heard several stories of people saying, like, for instance, those that have come from underbanked nations or areas of the world and then moved to America or moved to a more affluent area and then wanted to send money home. And there wasn't a way to get those finances back to their family safely and securely. But now with mobile technology and mobile phones being in almost every hand of every person in the world, even, you know, sub-Saharan Africa and these very, very remote locations, now you can talk about people getting valuable assets sent to them and then being able to have their own independent banking systems without the need for a centralized bank.
And this is another macro factor that is driving a lot of this adoption, because right now my incentives and Facebook's incentives are very much misaligned, and my incentives and Western Union's incentives, and I'm just picking on them because you mentioned sending money.
Sure. Yeah.
But our incentives are fundamentally misaligned, and there are lots of charts and graphs that are a lot of fun to consider. But at some point, companies get big enough that they have to prioritize their own interests over those of potential customers or even current customers.
Right.
And so that's where DeFi starts to really look interesting, because the interests of the service or the protocol, the contract, whatever it is, the token, are fundamentally aligned with those that own it. Mm-hmm. And it's a whole lot easier to enter.
Okay. I know there are other types of tokens that we could get into. For the sake of time, I'm going to move us forward. I think that maybe in a future episodes, we'll come back to some of those. There are three topics that I want to quickly cover in the last 10, 15 minutes, if we can wrap it up. DAOs, wallets, and dApps. So let's hit DAOs first. Who wants to take that? What is a DAO? DAO. What does that stand for?
Go ahead, Tyler. You said that you're super excited about them.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, as if it wasn't obvious. But a DAO is a decentralized autonomous organization. And like I said before, it's basically a community of people that have a certain level of ownership or authority or privilege, whether it's voting rights or just membership. And it is that group that sometimes it can function like a company. Mm-hmm. Where we're going to make money for the services that we provide. And sometimes it's more like a nonprofit. Sometimes it's like a B Corp. It just depends on the smart contract that governs participation in this DAO. And so when you, coming back to smart contracts, when I want to participate in a DAO, I acquire a token somehow. And in doing that, I'm participating in this smart contract. And so I get the benefits. I have to behave consistently with it. And And so it can be, there's a lot of models for what a DAO is anymore.
So Dan, you've talked about the parallels in your mind for DAOs in like ESOPs. It's a really helpful parallel for me. I know it's not a one-to-one because it's not obviously built on a smart contract. It has a slightly different governance model, but there is some parallels in the fact like an ESOP or an employee-owned right. organization is similar in the sense that there are, depending on how long you've been there or your position, you have different voting rights, but yet it's still something that has like, there's still an organizational structure to it. Mm-hmm. But it's being held or owned by something other than maybe just the original founders or an investment group or a private equity group. Mm-hmm. It's a different ownership model.
Yeah. It's very similar. So, mentioning that decisions are made from the bottom up, governed by the community. There are parallels to that in an ESOP of like, if you are maybe a traditional ownership, I may be butchering this, but if you're a traditional LLC or S corp, you know, you define maybe there's an ownership group, you know, maybe one person, two people, three people. But then if you move to an ESOP, there is a fairly lengthy process mm-hmm. of restructuring into an ESOP mm-hmm. that can take several months, but it's governed by rules. There's governing procedure. You specify how much of a certain, I guess, chunk of the company can be owned by the employees themselves versus previous owners, who has voting rights, vesting period. So there's, again, these protocols, quote unquote, that are written into these governance structures, very similar to a DAO. Yeah. So the parallels are similar.
Yeah, it's good.
And to contrast, like an ESOP, those already exist.
Right.
But
right.
In terms of governing them, there are people, and those people mm-hmm. can take time and fees, rightfully so, because we want to pay people for good work. But we have to acknowledge that the money that we pay, the many lawyers required to form and manage these kinds of relationships
the back office is extreme.
And so how the question is, how can more of that stay with the people actually doing the work rather than the overhead of managing them?
Right.
I think I'm with you. I think we're all kind of like, we're dancing around a little bit, but we're all very interested in that space in the future of it for lots of different projects. So I think we're seeing them happen. Right, primarily the place I've been seeing them the most, if you're looking up DAOs, is I tend to see them around organizations that are formed to govern cryptocurrencies. That's where I've seen them the most personally. They're probably used for lots of other areas, but that's where I'm tend to be seeing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Okay, let's hit the last two, wallets and dApps. So wallet, you've mentioned a couple times, Tyler, already as we talked through our conversation. This was probably the biggest barrier to entry and probably will be one of the biggest barrier to entry for most people that are just trying to like touch the tool, mm-hmm. right? Because
right.
you have to understand that you need a wallet to do anything. So maybe very simply, what is a wallet? And then we can talk about some popular ones just because there might be some people that go, which wallet do I use and how do I get one and that kind of thing. So I got a billfold. That's not true. My dad has a billfold. I have a little like thing that is on the side of my phone. And eventually I would rather not have these credit cards on the side of my phone through this little leather Apple thing. This would all be interconnected on a digital wallet. What are we talking about when we say wallets?
Yeah, so a wallet is a way to manage the various accounts that you have. So Coinbase has a wallet. And when you create an account on Coinbase, a user account or user profile, and you buy crypto, they give you get a crypto address, and then that is seen and managed from within your wallet. Another common wallet is MetaMask, and that's a browser extension that you can use.
That was the first one beyond the exchange. The first one that I actually started to use to look at NFTs and other places like that was MetaMask. It's probably the most popular.
Yeah, by far. And so the wallet, it's a Chrome extension because that's how you interact with Web3 websites. And we'll get into dApps in a minute. But in order to buy something on the internet through Ethereum, I need to do that through a wallet like MetaMask. And so the site will prompt me, it'll prompt MetaMask, and then I have to sign. You click a button, but you're essentially signing, saying, yes, I agree to interacting with this website. And so that's written onto the blockchain. And then if I want to buy something like an NFT or whatever that is, then that too is written onto my account through the wallet and then onto the blockchain itself.
Tyler, real quick, is there a, I'm guessing the answer is yes, but is there a reason or a, is there a reason why someone would need or want to have multiple wallets? The reason I ask is because that could get really, really cumbersome real fast.
It does.
Yeah. And so I guess maybe we can table that, but I think even, cause I think the last episode I mentioned, this just the mindset of entering into this brand new world that people are going to have to, but it's so confusing. Even things like that, which wallet do I use? Do I need multiple? How do I manage all of this? So anyways, just
can I suggest that maybe we punt that to another episode, because I think that's something we could unpack. Cause there's, I want to in future episodes, I'd love to talk more about the nuances of both the kind of risk rewards, the opportunities. Now that we have this language to work with and to talk with, where can it go? Both for good and maybe for risk and everywhere in between. And I think that what you're talking about is a lot of that I see as risk mitigation. Mm-hmm. But
yep, it's fourth and long. I say we punt it.
Okay. That was sports, right?
Sports ball.
Okay, cool. Okay, so we're only just touching on wallets, and I think that's a pretty good overview. But because the reality is that your wallet has an address. Your address has a public key. There's private keys. There's lots of different ways you can exchange things. So, for example, I hope you don't mind me saying, Tyler, that you minted some photography on OpenSea, and you gifted me one of those pictures. And so, like, you had to send it to my wallet to say George has the token that has the rights to the ownership of one of these pieces, and it was kind of you and I playing around to see how that would work and how that would play out. And so that's an example of the thing that proves that I have it is that my wallet's address is now written onto the Ethereum network. And it says out on the, can you go to Etherscan and see this? George's address is tied to this asset. And so on that asset, it's in reverse written onto the asset. Now there is a key that says this address is the owner of it. That address is owned by me in my particular wallet that is on my Chrome. And then I have a mobile app as well that I can access it.
I'm going to get you on a technicality, but only for clarity.
Oh, please.
Your address exists independent of MetaMask. So MetaMask is an interface for the blockchain.
That's good. It's really good.
And that's important. And I, it's important because
that's actually really good.
Again, all of this is readily visible to anybody, which is part, yes, Dan, there are many good reasons to have multiple wallets, multiple addresses, there are many good reasons to have multiple addresses and yes, even multiple wallets just to help you manage these things. And it's a crucial point, and bringing it back to the people of product, the point of the podcast, is that one of the biggest opportunities for anybody moving into this space is to make the UX readily understood and easily accessible and elegant. Because right now, one of the biggest barriers is there's so many steps and it's so confusing and it's not clear why you have to have a wallet and an address. And I thought I did this and I thought I did that, but now I go over here and it's not. And so the UX of this whole ecosystem, it's big and it's notable and it's making headlines, but as soon as the UX starts to catch up to everybody's expectations that are rooted in Web 2.0 experiences, that's when Web 3 starts to
100%
really gain steam. And that will be done in part because of dApps. So a dApp is a decentralized application that runs on the blockchain. Right now, when you download the Facebook app that goes through the App Store, it's made by a centralized company, Facebook, and then it goes through a centralized system run by Apple, and the data is stored practically it's stored in one place, and that's Facebook. And so Facebook has access to all of that data, and you don't get it unless you go through a whole heap of trouble. But for dApps, I want to make something clear, and then we can talk about them. But right now, the back end of a dApp is built on the blockchain. The front end, a lot of the front ends of dApps are written in React or Vue or whatever. The front end doesn't matter because you still have to have this interface that's compatible with the devices that we use day in, day out. But coming back full circle, blockchain, the data, and a lot of the functionality exists on the blockchain, and that's why it's decentralized.
So one of the things that we'll get to in the next few episodes, but I noticed that when I brought up the idea of Web3 being in the potential future for Crema, some of our developers were like, I don't know and I don't care, and why would I need to be involved in that? Until what you just said came up, which is, we're primarily a JavaScript shop, right? I mean, we do a ton of work in React, some Node work. Web 2.0 is not going away. Those platforms are still going to be needed as interfacing to this new computing technology. And that will be true for lots of different reasons. And even some of the dApps that I've signed on for, I have found that I don't want to say percentage, it's like 90% of it is Web3 backend. And then there's like this like 10% that's like a centralized server to reconcile some things. So for example, I might use my MetaMask wallet to sign up for a project or a service online, an exchange or an art gallery or something like that, right? And then it'll go, do you want to give us your email address, which is that's Web 2.0, right? Do you want to give us an email address and a password, Web 2.0 authentication, which means it's being stored on a server someplace for authentication so that we can notify you about things. Oh, okay. So you know, Web3 hasn't figured out notification systems very well yet. I mean, it'll come. Mm-hmm. We'll get there. So there are these centralized services which have platforms built that are just integrated like crazy for sending out emails and for sending out text messages and stuff like that that are just easier on Web 2.0. And so that's where we're saying earlier, and we talked about the current way we build apps is going to be around for a long time. There are special use cases where this thing called Web3, blockchain, decentralized computing, it is going to have a purpose. And it's very popular right now because it's new and it's novel and nobody gets it. And so we're all trying to get it. and so that's why we're, as Crema, we're very interested, because we think there will be niche opportunities there will be specific times when we're helping our clients do it, or maybe with Crema Ventures, we're doing it for ourselves, or whatever that might be, that we're playing with this new wave of computing and sharing ownership and things.
Yeah, and to go back to something you said, when I download a dApp, it's connecting to a particular address on the Ethereum network. And then that data, that information, I don't have to create a new account for every new website. Right. And I don't have to use my Google account, which is a centralized. And Google has done enough to earn my trust in terms of my the security of my email and password. And also use things like 1Password and that kind of thing, of course. But if I were to sign up for another dApp, they could, I mean, right now they'll use that same MetaMask and have access to that same information. And it's not information that I hold deeply personal either. And so again, this publicly available, composable, like apps can interact with my wallet equally well, regardless of who built them and who's storing that data, because Facebook doesn't own that data. Google doesn't own that data.
It's fun. I mean, the reason we're letting our listeners kind of get a peek behind the scenes of us exploring. I know we said we'd try to make this episode short, but we got to an hour, y'all.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No, I mean, there's a lot to cover.
I'm tired.
Wow. I've got another 45 minutes of material, George.
I know. We got hours of material. You and I have talked a lot. I want everyone to tune in. If you're not subscribed to the podcast already, if someone has shared this episode with you, for context, People Product primarily is about product teams, product culture, and whether it's in an agency or in-house or anywhere in between, we're really trying to help people think, how do you build teams, equip people, train individuals to think differently so that they can create, design, build solutions that help people thrive, right? And we do believe that this new technology will be a factor for sure in the future of everything that we do, which is like, I think, gosh, I know that we've all been peeking around it for a little while, but in the last 3 to 5 months is when it was like, we have to pay attention.
Go ahead. It's not going to just be a technology shift. This is not like moving from React to Angular. It's a mindset shift in the way that we work as teams, the way that we see our customers, the way that we see their relationship with technology and all that. It's not just, oh, we're going to learn how to work in Solidity.
Well, it's even the way we see ownership. It's a difference in the way we see ownership, the way we see community, the way we discuss the ethical way to build technology. I mean, honestly, I mean, it goes deeper than that. Yeah.
So let's unpack that as we go forward. I think we're gonna take a bunch of these topics that we've kind of mentioned here, and we'll come back to this jargon and this vocabulary. So if you listen to future episodes, or if you're on the first episode and you're a little confused about what this whole Web 1.2.3 is, this episode is really just to give a very quick overview of a lot of the jargon. I will see if I can't work with the team to get the majority of our notes here actually just copied and pasted right into the show notes. So there's a bunch of links that we're pulling from, and there are a lot more. And there are lots of podcasts of people that have already been in this space for years that can go and nerd out on it a lot further. But if you're following us because you're interested about product culture, about design, creativity, and technology, and how people are doing the future of work, we want to introduce you to this topic because we're exploring it ourselves. So I'm more excited than I probably have been in a long time for just something new. It feels like we've been talking about the same thing for a long time. So it feels really exciting to be jumping into a new topic. And Dan, Tyler, thank you so much for exploring this with me today. And like I said, subscribe, follow us, and share this out, because we're going to be diving even deeper in over the next couple episodes. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Love it.
Bye.
Bye now.
See you.
This episode of People of Product was produced by Larissa McCarty with support from Julie Branson and Steph Inger. Our hosts are George Brooks and Daniel Linhart. People of Product is brought to you by Crema, a digital product agency. We believe that creativity, technology, and culture can help individuals and organizations thrive. Learn more at crema.us.